So my podcast this week is totally different from previous weeks. And as the first season comes to an end, I decided to introduce you to the lady behind this whole production, the infamous Kate Cocker. And she's probably the only other person that I've had to listen to during lockdown. Today, she's going to interview me. I haven't got a clue what I'm in for. I apologise in advance, but as they say, on with the show.
Hello. So I've spent the last 4 months with you, or 6 months, I should say, with you, on the other end of all these interviews that you've done. And so I've learned about you, really, in the last 6 months. I'd never met you before, didn't know who you were. And as a business owner myself, I'm really excited about interviewing you today because I've got tons of little, I know little bits about you, but we've never really dug deep on things. So I'm going to go for some of the events that made you, but I'm also going to dig around in there as well. Is that all right?
It is. But should we just, for the listeners' benefit, tell them about how we first met? It's quite interesting, and I think it reflects sort of how I operate. But you were recommended to me to help me with my consultancy business, my public speaking, learning to speak without notes. And in fairness, the podcast sort of just evolved out of that. That wasn't the original plan. And I never forget, you came in so enthusiastic. And, you know, I respond really well to enthusiasm, communication, eye contact. You know, that floats my boat. So if somebody addresses me or interacts with me in that way, I listen. And I remember watching you go out and I'd given you the business. I wanted to work with you. I liked your energy. And as you walked out the door, I thought to myself, she's shitting herself. And that is really, really good. And I think I was right, wasn't I? You thought...
Yeah, you were right.
I know. I got it in one. But that made me even more confident that you were the right person to guide me down this road to the other events that are going to make me. Sorry for that. But anyway, audience, that's how we met.
Yes, that's how we met. And actually, it's a really important point because I think for me, I worry all the time. I feel like, as a business owner, I want to deliver for my clients all of the time. I want to deliver, 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 deliver. And I get wrapped up in that. And that's where I'm really vulnerable. So what was really nice when you've told me that in the past, to understand that that's a bit of a strength is actually really, you know, as a business owner, you're scared all the time. You say that.
I am, but you'd never know. I would never let you know when I walked out of the office that I was shitting myself. But it is a strength, Kate, and it's one that, you know, you should embrace because I think that it gives people confidence in you when you are that little bit vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it, you know, that has really helped me along
anyway,
the way.
Anyway, that's the end of your therapy session. Let's go on to talking about you.
So, okay, I'm going to do the intro then. So you've run Taylor Lynn Corporation for over 30 years. The story goes that you set it up with £200 in your pocket. It's now a multi-million pound events business. You've won awards as a business leader. You've been on telly. You've won an award for that as well, as Millionaire Party Planner. You've literally got events that have made you. So there's Children in Need with Gary Barlow. There's, as we've learnt from this series, Lisa Riley's birthday, Eamon Holmes's birthday, Sally Lindsay's wedding. You've done parties on royal appointment. It's quite impressive, that. So my first question to you is, how do you measure your success on a day-to-day basis?
It's a very interesting question, that, Kate, because I don't. I know that I've been successful and I know that I am proud of what I've achieved. Not as proud as my mother, who's 87, but I am proud of what I've achieved. But I never sit back and think, right, you know, I've done it now. I've got a great company. I've won these awards, because you never, ever know what's around the corner, as we all know. I mean, look what's happened this year. And so you can never be complacent. I am not complacent. I wake up every day and if I've got £1 million in the bank, I worry that I haven't got £1.5 million in the bank. And that's how I've always operated.
Do you think that there's something that's made you that way?
Oh, listen, we haven't got that long and I've had 5 years of therapy and I've delved into all that. Yes, I had a very difficult upbringing. I was very challenged as a child. My father was a judge. He was hugely successful. I never made the grade because if I got an A, I never got an A plus. I was a bit of a wild child, so I never towed the line. And yeah, and then my parents split up when I was 17 and I was left to sort of sink or swim. And I think that gave me the drive. And unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you look at it, my personal life has had a huge effect on my professional life. So as a single mum at 30 with no income and an ex-husband who was, you know, totally oblivious to the responsibilities that he had with two young children, I, in true Liz Taylor fashion, you know, took the reins and got on with it. And that's been my drive. And I failed along the way. I have failed, but I haven't failed myself. I've never let myself down. I might have failed in projects, but I've learned from it. And I always say now, you know, 30 odd years later, when I've done a party and I phone up on the Monday to make sure the client's happy, I always say, OK, give me the bad news first. We'll talk about the good news afterwards. Because whatever it is, it's constructive criticism and you're never too old to learn. And that's my ethos.
So I think it's really interesting in your business because the radio business that I'm from, my background is that every day is almost a rehearsal and a performance at the same time. So if you've got radio presenters on the radio, every link that they do, every time they speak between the music, it could be good, it could be bad, but the next one could be better, the next one could be better, and it's gone. Like, especially like 10 years ago before like iPlayer was existed or anything like that, it's gone. So they could forget about it. For you, you're building up to an event every single time, right? So do you get stuck in the trying to make the event perfect every single time?
No, Kate, I'm running a business. Mm. That's first and foremost. The business happens to be in production. And my production is not theatre, it's not plays, it's not concerts, it's parties, it's corporate events, and it's a one night only. But ultimately, I am running a business and the detail that is involved in that is crucial to the end result. And I often say this to people, yes, when I walk in to Narnia and I walk through a wardrobe that I've had a set designer build and I trundle my way through mink coats down a snow-filled walkway, I mean, it, you know, as you talk about it, your arms tingle because it's magical. But all the work's been done. That is the party, I suppose, in some respects has been and gone because the detail and the efforts that we put in the office are why I, and this sounds, I'm going to say it as it is, why I am so successful, because I am anal right to the last drop of snow. And then I go to that event. It runs seamlessly because I'm surrounded by the most amazing band of suppliers and producers. And then the Monday morning, I'm on to the one for the next weekend. So it's not as, when I say it's not as focused, I don't home in on that one project. I home in on a business that is working, can be working on 10 projects at one time.
And where's your let go moment? Because when I'm, as a producer, when I've produced radio in the past, say I was doing a Saturday morning breakfast and we would iron out that programme over and over and over and over and over and over again, hit Friday 7 o'clock when everyone's gone to bed and I let go because it's over to the rest of the team then. Do you have that moment?
Are you kidding me? No, that's my problem. I'm an absolute useless. I'm useless at delegating. And they know that. And do you know what? This is the God's honest truth. When we do, you know, events over 200, we're always all on walkie-talkies. So yeah. You've got kitchen and you've got lighting and you've got sound and you've got production. I am always, always put on a different channel. So that I can't hear anybody and I am talking to myself. And it was only about 18 months ago and I thought, what's going on here? No one's answering me. I can't hear anyone. And they're all, you know, and that is the God's honest truth. Unless there's a crisis pending or they can see that I'm needed, I suppose they humour me and they get on with it because they know what my expectations are. That's right. What I love about working with the people that I do.
What's the event you've done that you're most proud of?
This sounds so cheesy and hammy. I'm proud of every single one because every single one has been a learning curve that's taken me to where I am today. Obviously, I married two daughters and I suppose that pride was mixed with emotion and, you know, I was having personal traumas at the time, but I did them proud and they had I was a little bit selfish. I used it to demonstrate what I could do. But they were sort of my heartwarming moments. Professionally, you know, I've worked for corporates for 17 years and I've grown with them and I've contributed to directors, you know, overseas events, all sorts of challenging stuff. But, you know, yeah, OK, so you do feel a bit proud when Kensington Palace phone you and say, can you do a gig for Prince William in 3 weeks' time? And when Gary Barlow's PA phones and says, you know, can you come and see him next week? And Robbie Williams says, do you want to come for Thanksgiving dinner? Yeah, I'm proud, but I don't get caught up in the, not insincerity, but it's sort of the icing on the cake. It's not contributing to the food on the table, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's easy to get lost in the showbiz of that, but actually they are just people as well, that, you know, the people that have a brief and you have to deliver that brief, right?
Yeah, and also what I love about it, and I hope none of them are listening to this because I'll probably never work for them again, but especially Howard Donald, because I was ironing Howard's shirt when he was reading me his wedding speech and he said to me, what do you think of this, mate? And I thought, is this for real? I've got to take that, reading me his wedding speech. I'm ironing shirts and I've never ironed a shirt in my life. But they're putty in my hands. And that's what I love. And I sort of get a really insane pleasure, a perverse pleasure, when you see these rock stars and you're saying to them, no, look, listen to me. You know, this is how you need to spend your money. You need to have one long table and let's create a banquet. And they're like nodding up and down and going, okay, Liz, if that's what you think we should do. And so there is a perverse pleasure. Equally, Kate, it's a huge responsibility.
Yes.
Because if you cock up, you're finished.
Yeah.
You're only as good as your last event.
You're listening to The Events That Made Me with her, Liz Taylor, interviewed by me, Kate Cocker. So I asked you to give me some events that you think made you. And first on the list was the IRA bomb in 1996. Now, we talk about this bomb in Manchester as a bit of a defining moment for the city, which I think sometimes, because we're so blithely we say it, I think it almost sounds insensitive. But we always have to remember no one died. And it actually, what it did was it generated a massive investment into the city. Why was it such an important event for you?
I think the great thing about Manchester, and I think we've seen that recently, is that it's one of those cities that has that rare camaraderie that everybody comes together when there is a crisis. And there have been some horrendous incidents over the last few years, and everybody has really pulled together. For me, it was the defining moment because I could see that the investment that was going in the city was going to be so huge that Manchester would really be on the map as the second city in the UK. You know, it was London, and then there was a question mark, was it Birmingham? And it became Manchester. And I think that the enthusiasm and the investment that went into restaurants, bars, venues, concert halls, all sort, you know, GMEX. And then we've got, you know, we've got two of the biggest clubs in the world. We've got Manchester United and Manchester City. We've got one of the longest running soaps ever, Coronation Street. These were all clients of mine. I was sort of tiptoeing into it. And for me, that was the event that made me, that gave me the confidence to realise that I could make a success of this. And I saw the opportunities that were there, and it was up to me to go and grasp them.
Is there an example of that happening? You know, was there an event that literally came off the back of the investment?
In focusing on this turnaround in the city, the contacts that I made included people like Charles Allen, who was the chairman of Granada, David Liddiman, Jules Burns, Steve Morrison. These are all kings of TV. The radio presenters, anyone that was a king or a queen was on my hit list, whether that be in media or whether it be in the hotel game, sports. I had started working for Manchester United in 1995, so I already had my feet under the door there. So it was a strategy. You know, none of this just happened, Kate. It was something that was really, you know, I planned. Did I think it would ever be so successful? No, I didn't, because at that time, you think, what? Who's going to pay somebody to make you a party? You're mad. You know, I made my own. But they do, and they did.
So, OK, so you said it was a strategy. Talk me through how you get to someone like Charles Allen. How does that happen?
You know, somebody once said to me that one of my strengths was that I am not intimidated by anybody. And I remember when I had lunch with Prince Andrew and I'd been warned, there were 16 of us at the table, all 15 men and me. And the guy that had introduced me, was taking me, said to me, for God's sake, just sitting next to him, do not mention his children and do not mention his charities. So I said, OK. And anyway, we sit there and there's deathly silence. You've got these butlers coming around with the silver trays and nobody knows whether to go right or left. And I looked and I thought, well, what's he going to do? He's either going to get up and tell me to leave, or he's going to ignore me for the rest of the lunch, or he's going to engage. And so amidst this silence, I turned round to him and I said, sir, you know, I was warned today that I was going to be sitting next to you, and I was told under no uncertain terms was I to discuss your children or your charities. So which would you like to discuss first? And he said to me, well, let's discuss my children. And that's just an example. I had Prince Charles, who I met through, I was the only woman on the Prince's Trust Northwest many years ago, and I had a badge on. And he leaned in and said, oh, you said the other Liz Taylor. I said, no, sir, the Liz Taylor. And so it's just having the chutzpah to go for it. And I did a Christmas party for Coronation Street, and Charles Allen was there, and I went up to him and I stuck my hand out and I said, Mr. Allen, can I introduce myself? I'm Liz Taylor. I'm from Liz Taylor Associates, which it was at the time, and I've produced this event for you. And he said, lovely to meet you. And when he eventually did the closing ceremony for the Queen for the Commonwealth Games, he remembered Liz Taylor, who'd introduced him at the Victoria and Albert Hotel. And I got the call and I did it. And so it's walking across the room. That's what I do. I walk across the room and that number goes in my black book.
This leads nicely on to a thing that I wanted to talk to you about. You are obsessed with branding, OK? My first inclination of this was in that first episode with Catherine Tilsley, where you start a question, you say, now my girls know that they're not allowed to wear blue jeans, you know, because it's all about image, it's all about their branding. They're not allowed to wear blue jeans, that was right, wasn't it? You should dress as if Prince William is about to walk through the door, is what you say. And I think in that situation, I'm a bit similar. I kind of, maybe not quite as much as you, but I'm aware of things like, when I was a student, I ran for a campaign to be head of media. And everywhere I went, I made sure I had my hair in those ridiculous top knots that I wear sometimes, like little bunches. But I was like, I always dressed the same. I had a red leather jacket, top bunches, because I was like, every time they see me, they have to know it's me, it's my brand. Tell me about why branding to you is so important.
Because many years ago, I started in fashion. I did management training with Marks and Spencers. And then for 10 years, I was in fashion retail. And I worked for the big boys. And there was a privately owned company then called Crocodile who did very, very upmarket, expensive designer stuff. And Peter Davis, who owned Crocodile, he had a buyer that worked for him who I'm still friendly with to this day. And she said to me, whatever you do, if you go out on your own, create a brand. And it stuck with me. I don't know. It was just something that really, really resonated with me. And your brand is your label. I'm proud of my brand. The Taylor Lynn Corporation is a really strong, respected brand. People may not like me. They may not respect me. They may not want to work with me. But the brand is king. And that's all I care about. And I know that when my girls go out and say that they work for the Taylor Lynn Corporation, they go, oh, my God, do you? What's she like? You know, is it horrendous and all that? And they go, no, she's fine. You know, whatever they say, I don't know. But I remember one girl saying to somebody, oh, well, don't worry, a bark's worse than a bite or something. But I don't really care about that. I only care that my brand sits up there in my industry at the top.
And how do you make that happen?
I could tell you, but I think I'd have to kill you first, because if I share all that on this radio, on this podcast, everyone else is going to go and do it. Okay. But you do, it's strategy, isn't it? It is. It's, you know, it's, I've never, for instance, and this is basic stuff, I've never invested in PR and marketing when things have not been good. Yeah. I've only invested in it when things have been absolutely flying, because you can't, it's much easier to promote something that is doing well than it is to promote something that isn't doing well. I've always followed my competition but never reacted to them. So if somebody's doing something, I've thought, fine, well, that's their strategy, but actually let them get on with it because I'm very confident in what I'm doing. During lockdown, the first thing that I did was something I'd wanted to do for a long time. That was set up a consultancy, which I did in March. And I did it a bit tongue-in-cheek. I thought, you know, OK, I don't know what's going to happen here. I've got no events till next year. The event, my girls are furloughed. Am I going to have a business? And that is using all my skills, my brand, my black book, my knowledge, my confidence to give to other hospitality businesses. And I'm going to make sure that I am totally indispensable so that they can't have short-term contracts with me. And, you know, one's just taken me on for 12 months. And that's been, for me, that's been the most, that's been another event that's made me. Because in times of complete disaster, I've managed to create a brand.
It's the same woman that walked across that room and introduced herself to Charles Allen, isn't it? It's you. You're the brand.
Yes, I am the brand, which is why I've probably never been able to sell the business, because at one time I did look at selling the event business and sort of, you know, going onto a beach somewhere and making those margaritas that the bar guys have taught me to make so well and, you know, sit reminiscing about all those wonderful parties. Anyway, needless to say, that is not happening anytime soon. And I can't sell the brand without me. So, yeah, would I have done it differently? Probably slightly. But you know what, Kate, I'm having the best time.
I know you are. I'm here. I'm watching you do it. It's great fun. I'm on for the ride, babes. One of the other things that you said to me, you were like, here are the events, recession. Like, yeah. You know, on your website, it says you've navigated the Taylor Lynn Corporation through many a recession. When you say recession, which one do you mean?
I think I've been involved in them all. But, you know, these moments in history have a huge impact on my business because my business is a luxury business. And it's the last thing that people want to invest in when their livelihood is compromised. What I did during the recessions, I had a very, very strong corporate client base and it included a lot of the banks. And the banks used to do client entertaining, they used to do staff incentives, they used to do overseas events, they would do recognition events, gala dinners, you know, anything, HSBC, Royal Bank of Scotland, Barclays. It was so competitive and they were all out there to do bigger and better. So they were the first to pull back when the recession hit. But what I did, I went to them and said, look, I don't care how small the gig is. You need to keep your brand out there. So whatever dinners you've got, whether you want to spend £500, £1,000, and we're talking, you know, a drop from spending 150 grand then to £1,000. And I stuck with them. I stuck with all the hotels. The hotels will say, look, could you do this? Could you do us a favour? Would you? And I say, yeah, if I can get my brand in lights outside the hotel to that company, I'll do whatever you want. And by this time, I'd set up a linen hire business. So I had chair covers and we just pooled all the resources to support the businesses that eventually supported us.
And that, you know, I think that's a bit of what's happening now, is it? Do you see that now?
I think now is the survival of the fittest. You know, I've watched other companies and the direction that they've gone, and I was always adamant that live events would come back. Live events were king. I never wanted to embrace virtual events because I thought they'd be short-lived. I've always had a very impressive private client base, high net worth. So, you know, you've got the John Cordwells of this world and those sorts of people that still do private parties. Yeah, their budgets might change, but you're talking serious money. And they want the best, and they come to us. And that's been my saving grace. And next year, I've got some really fabulous, meaty, wonderful projects. And the corporate will come back. I've picked up a corporate client this week that I lost to a competitor last year. The competitor's floundering. They've contacted me. So I've always had the confidence. I've always had the confidence in myself and I follow my gut. And my gut so far has taken me down the right road.
I want to ask you if there is an event that you can pinpoint that has made you trust yourself so much.
30 years ago, when I had just started in business, I was recommended to an Indian family by Norma. I don't know if she's still alive, but she used to run Quaffers in Bredbury. Do you remember it? It was a little bit of a hole, and it had this stage that used to come up out from underneath. It was a huge place. Anyway, she was my mate, Norma. She recommended me to anybody. Anyway, this guy came. I'll cut it very short. At the time, I was recently divorced, and my office was at home, and it eventually became a downstairs toilet. So I'm talking, it was like 8 foot by 2 foot. And he gave me a job. He gave me the engagement party, and I did it. And they took a punt on me, really, but I don't think they had anyone else to go to. And then I got a call from the bride, who was based in Newcastle, to do her wedding. And the story, you can read it in my book when my book comes out later in the year. It's a long story. But that was the event, I think, that made me. It was 1,200 people in a marquee in a park in Newcastle. If you think about the infrastructure that went into that, so forget the guests, you can imagine toilets for staff, you know, 100 staff, the generators, the catering, the back of house, the tables. So you had 1,200 people in for a ceremony, then you had another space, 1,200 people in for dinner. And I was totally and utterly out of my depth, totally. But I knew that it was my turning point. I knew it was my shining hour. What I didn't know is that when you organise an Indian event, they're a nightmare because they come with all the family. So we ended up with 1,500 people, not 1,200 people. And I've learned, I'm still working for these guys today. And when they say to me, you know, we've got 250 people, I go, okay, we've got 500 people. And so, you know, and I'm well-versed with all the ceremonies and the religious things and everything. But organising that and accepting that challenge with not a bloody clue what I was doing is probably the thing that turned my life around.
It's the adage of say yes and work it out later.
Say yes to the dress. Yeah.
Yes. Just work it out later.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. You're listening to Events That Made Me with me, Liz Taylor. Find me on all the socials as at Liz Taylor Consultancy.
Okay, so when you talked to Lisa Riley on another episode in the series, you touched on a personal event, which is the Jewish divorce, which is called the Get. And I've done my research on this because I looked it up and it says, this is the moment that you are hereby permitted to all men. And I know you've been through that. So tell me about it.
Well, Lisa and I had both been glued to Unorthodox, which was on Netflix, and the most amazing insight into my religion and heritage and the very religious and the restrictions that women have put upon them when they enter into that sanctity of marriage. And we talked about doing a programme on this with Kim Winston. We want to investigate the whole Get thing. It's a very humiliating experience. A man has to give a woman a get officially, so there has to be permission. And if you can't get divorced or remarried in the religion without it. And it's archaic. And it's a very traumatic thing to have to go through. And if you haven't listened to it, then listen to the Lisa Riley Events That Made Me episode, because it's very insightful. And I suppose the only thing, if I was being a little bit blasé, is that I didn't realise I had to go through it to be permitted to all men. Maybe that's where I was going wrong.
Now, the other reason I brought up divorce is because when I said to you, right, what events do you think made you? You said divorce. How does such a personal event like a divorce drive you in your business?
Well, remember, when I got married, which was 40 years ago, it was a long time ago, and I had my two children who are now mid-30s, then it was very much, and particularly in the Jewish religion, you know, the man looks after the woman, the man is the provider. You know, my father was the provider in our family, my mother never worked, and so that was the expectation. Things are hugely different now, and were starting to be different then, but because I'd struggled as a child and had to everything that I ever wanted, and I don't just mean materially, I mean everything I ever achieved, I had to do myself. You know, I wasn't the most academic, but I was quirky and I was talented. I played the piano. And so everything I did for myself. And I've carried that through. So when I got divorced and I found myself vulnerable with two young children, I wasn't prepared to hang around to wait for somebody to support us or help us. I was totally driven in a world that was changing. And I suppose that's probably, not only am I very proud of it, but it definitely, definitely is an event that made me.
There's something about, isn't there, having to be on your own that makes you strategize differently. I know that sounds really obvious, but it is different, isn't it? When you're like, right, I'm on my own now. What are the things I need to put in place that mean that I can support myself?
Yeah, and it's the challenge. You know, I never, ever considered that I wouldn't be not successful, independent. I never considered I wouldn't be independent. I never considered my children were in private education, which had been funded by a trust fund, which all of a sudden had gone. And, you know,
was that through the marriage or through the trust fund?
The trust fund was set up by their paternal grandfather. So there was nothing left. But I never considered moving them out. My only focus was how I would take on that responsibility. And they say, you know, if you put out into the universe what you want, it comes to you. And I really believe that. I think that, you know, there's a lot now with mental health and well-being, and we never had access to the facilities that we've got now, but they were there. And I put out to the universe and I got what I wanted. I got two, you know, privately educated, university educated children that have the utmost respect for me and taken on board the challenges that I went through in order to give that to them.
Yeah, and I imagine that inspired them as well to be totally more independent and stronger and all of those things.
Totally, and they're probably my, you know, the two most proudest things I have, that is that, you know, they've come out. They're not, yeah, okay, all right, they're a bit spoiled. You know, if they want a Zara shop, then I'm a soft touch. But they are not spoiled in that they appreciate everything that I did in order to give them the foundations of success.
And you went through another type of divorce as well, because when you set up Taylor Lynn Corporation, that was with Diane Lynn. And then I don't know how long ago it was, but you went your separate ways, didn't you? Was that like a divorce? Was that hard?
That I found really hard. That was back in 2008. And I think that, you know, at the time, Diane didn't want it. And I think that now, in retrospect, she would probably agree that it was the right thing for us both at that time. The thing I miss about that is that I'm so passionate about what I do and so committed to what I do. She was my right arm and I was her left. And we used to think the same. We used to speak 100 times a day. We had a common goal and we were building an empire. We were both Pisces, very different actually in characters. She was probably, I was far more emotional than her, but you wouldn't have thought that if you met the two of us. She was always late, I was always early. You know, it was the yin and the yang. And I miss it terribly because she chose not to continue the relationship after we split up. We speak, but we are not in touch. And that I do miss because she was my creative mood board. And we produced some amazing stuff together. We travelled all over the world together. But, you know, that's life. And I don't regret making that decision. It was definitely the right way for us both to go.
What was the reason that you decided to separate?
There were lots of reasons, but right, we had different priorities. And she was, at the time, her main business was Springbank Flowers, which was the support to the Taylor Lynn Corporation. So I worked full-time in one, she worked full-time in the other. And financially, she was very much a part of the Taylor Lynn Corporation. It was just going different ways. We'd had different objectives. And there comes a time, you know, in a lot of businesses, I suppose, in retrospect, I was advised not to go in 50-50 and to go in sort of 70-30, because I was the events, she was the flowers. My personality was such that if somebody was not equal, I reckon that I'd sort of piss all over them and it wouldn't work. So that was my decision to go 50-50. Would I have done it differently? Maybe. But, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And I have absolutely no regrets in life whatsoever. I would still go through the bad to have the good.
Okay, but do you agree then that people are fearful of going into business on their own and often lean towards the appeal of going into business with another?
Going in business with somebody else gives you the security network that you think that you are lacking. It gives you the confidence that to make a decision because you've got a bouncing board. And I miss that now. You know, I'm in business on my own and I've got a number of different businesses that I'm running and I don't have anybody to bounce it off. But eventually you realise that actually you are confident enough. We all have to make the wrong decision along the way in order to get to the right decision. I had an amazing article in the You magazine this weekend, which was written by Katie Malloy, who was doing social media for me, and she considered me her mentor. And when I read the article and saw her perception of me in business, I was really chuffed because I'd never considered myself a mentor. Yes, I've done it with young kids, but some of the things that she picked out of my character, I was really proud of. So now my next thing, Kate, for all the listeners here, I am now setting up a mentor program for everybody that wants to listen to what I've got to say. So you don't need the cotton wool. You know, you can take the plaster off and just acknowledge you're going to make a few mistakes, but the mistakes will take you on the right road to success.
When Simon Lycett and you had your conversation at the beginning, it was one of the first episodes, that there was a moment that I thought was very revealing, which was Simon talking about how when he comes to your house and you make the best Negronis, obviously, he said, you get to a certain point, it's like lights out, bedtime, off we go, bye. You're like, I'm done now. And I really do imagine you to be a great host when you've got your friends over. But how do you celebrate? How do you like to celebrate?
First of all, I'm a bit of an early bird. You know, I like to be in bed dead early and I like to watch my... When I'm not working... I mean, I work late most nights. And when I'm not working, I like to get into bed and watch Corrie and eat digestive biscuits and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, Simon and Nicholas can sit up till stupid o'clock. And I've had enough, you know. We've had one night, and it was when I was going through my divorce, and they insisted I go and stay with them because I was in a bit of a bad way. And they said, you've got to be dressed for such and such a time, and we're going out to eat, and the car rocked up. Anyway, they'd booked to Asia to Cuba in London in St Martin's Lane, which was one of my favourite restaurants. And they were taking me to, I can't remember the place, but it's on the 40th floor of the Heron building for drinks. And we never made it past the drinks. We were absolutely, completely rat arse that we ended up having fish and chips. You know, Simon is just a very spontaneous, and he'll sit and he's... So, yeah, I have to say to him, you know what, it's time to go to bed now. Otherwise, we'd just sit up forever. And, I've got too many wrinkles, Kate, for that. I need my beauty sleep. But he... And also, you know... When I always wanted to go to India, and I went with Simon and Nicholas last year, and I think that's probably one of the, apart from my kids, it's the best holiday I have ever had in my entire life. Mm-hmm. We had the most amazing trip. He's just an interesting, eclectic, ridiculously talented friend, and, you know, I love them. So, and when you're friends, you can tell them to bugger off to bed, can't you?
Yeah, you can. That's
exactly
the point of having friends like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
But how do you celebrate? Like, if there's something in your life worth celebrating, what do you do?
Well, I've had great parties. I had the best 50th in the world. It was in a marquee in Diane Lynn's garden. Flew over a violinist and a DJ from New York. I bought an antique baby grand piano that I painted red and I put them on it. And I had sushi stations. I had all different foods. It was absolutely brilliant. I asked friends, I asked clients, and I loved it. Then my 60th, I had at Delamere Manor, and I had about 80 people, and I did a dinner. In retrospect, I didn't enjoy it as much because I was struggling to save my marriage at the time, and it was, I wasn't in a particularly good place. Since then, every birthday, I've taken friends. Last year, we went to the Ivy for lunch. I celebrate with the people that I spend time with, the people I want to be with. I won't spend time with anybody that I don't want to. Now, that can be a right mix of people, and if they don't get on, then it's tough shit. I like little. I like quite intimate things. I'm not great at go. Yeah, I do. I do. I'm a dinner party girl.
When you do your bigger events, do you have to put a lot of effort into making sure you're marching across rooms to meet people, or do you focus on the sort of people who are around you?
No, the best event planners are the ones that are not seen. You know, when you manage it from behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Or you just give a look and they see, and they're looking at the time that they should be looking. But marching across with a clipboard and an earpiece that isn't plugged into anybody is really not my bag.
It's also pointless.
The only thing on the clipboard is the Ocado order.
Brilliant. Oh, Liz, this has been fantastic to talk to you in this way and actually sort of pick at some of the stories that I wanted to pick out, which has been fab. What did you get out of season one of your podcast?
I absolutely loved it. And I've had a wonderful response from people that I never even imagined would listen to it. And I know that we've sort of been fixated on the ratings and, you know, whether it's up or whether it's down. But I actually think it's something that's going to grow. I'm very, very excited because I'm interviewing Got One next week, and he's going into season two. And season two is going to be a little bit more business focused rather than celebrity focused, because I want people to understand and and share stories that have made them a success. But I've really loved spending time chatting to friends, and that's what it's been all about.
Yeah, we'll find you some people you don't know next time as well, so you could get even more nosy.
Kate Cocker, I know everybody. That's the end of this first series, and a huge thank you to all my guests. And thank you if you've left a review or a rating. It all helps. I'll be back with a new series very soon, so make sure you subscribe or follow, depending on where you listen, so that you get news of the new episodes first. In the meantime, you can find me on all the socials as @LizTaylorConsultancy. And come see me on my website, liz-taylor-consulting.co.uk. So see you soon for more events that made me, with me, Liz Taylor.